Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome in to another edition of The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. I am your host, Jeff Nadeau. Hope you're having a great day wherever you are. And it is a busy week for me. It is fight week. And I've got a lot of DMs about this. What do you mean fight week? Well, it's fight week. I am fighting this Friday, December 10th, in an amateur boxing event called Rough and Rowdy, presented by Barstool Sports. And, you know, it's a contentious fight for sure. The individual I'm fighting and I definitely have a beef, and we're going to hash it out for a couple of minutes in the ring. And for anyone that's curious, you can watch the event. It is pay-per-view. You can buy it at buyrnr.com, which I included in the description. So it's a busy week for me. I've got to head down to West Virginia on Wednesday, there till Saturday when I will return back to Pennsylvania. But I wanted to get an episode out this week. Obviously, we can't skip a week without the sit down. People expect our mob coverage and they're going to get it today. We got another great episode planned for you. And I know a lot of people contacted me last week about the Benny Ong episode. They enjoyed it, a little bit of a change of pace. And we got another great episode today. We're going to talk about Jimmy Brown failure. And Jimmy Brown is really an interesting guy. Comes up in the Mangano crime family many years ago, was the driver for Carlo Gambino, eventually obviously becomes one of the most prolific earners in the family, controlled garbage for 30 plus years in New York City. When we think about garbage in New York City, it is a huge undertaking. There are 200,000 plus businesses in New York City, and the mob controlled the garbage pickup and carting in pretty much all of them. They had a monopoly, and Jimmy Brown ran that. Jimmy Brown was definitely a pragmatist. He was one that fell in line, but he was incredibly powerful, and that would happen really late in his career. Even John Gotti would have to deal with the KG failure. So a lot to get into with Jimmy Brown. And you know, I've always said, you know, he's one of my favorite mobsters. You know, I think when it really comes down to it, I think Jimmy Brown's probably one of the most powerful nondescript people we don't talk about in the history of Cosa Nostra. He really was able to make a ton of money. He lived the code of the streets. He didn't talk. He was never caught on surveillance. He was never caught on wiretap. He moved like a gangster should. And he learned from Carlo Gambino that silence is king. You know, the fish, you know, with his mouth open is always the one that gets caught, you know, and he lived by that oath really until the end. We'll talk about all that more. As always, make sure you go follow us on Twitter at the Sit Down 7. I make sure every week I try to put out, you know, interesting Cosa Nostra moments or movie quotes or things of that nature. So it's a good way to kind of keep up with what's going on with the show and more. You can also check us out on YouTube. You can just search The Sit Down. I try to put out some really good videos just about smaller subjects or subjects we can't spend an hour on. Next week, we'll be back with another episode, and I'll either be 0-1 or 1-0. And I'm going to be 1-0. I'm going to make sure that the latter happens. It's a fight. You never know what happens, but I'm really confident going into it, and I can't wait to get going on Friday. But without further ado, let's get to Jimmy Brown. And I also wanted to quickly talk about, people have asked me where Blackjack has been. Keep in mind, you know, Blackjack just has a lot going on. He's still on the show. Blackjack just has been traveling a lot for his other job. He runs a gambling content website. He's actually in Canada this week, so he'll be back kind of once we get past the new year. Everything will really kind of settle down for each of us, and we'll get back to our normal routine. But I've really been happy with the ability we have of people like RJ Roger from Black Camper Mafia to fill in. And we actually recorded a show Sunday night with RJ, but we had some technical issues, and we weren't able to kind of figure it all out. So it is what it is. We'll get RJ back real soon. Make sure you go check out his channel on YouTube. One of the great YouTube channels out there, Black Handprint Mafia. It puts a lot of great content out, really from kind of a intelligence scholarly standpoint. So make sure you go and check that out. All right, let's get into Jimmy Brown Fiala. And I will say, usually we have some pretty colorful and creative come-ups or childhoods, not much from Jimmy Brown. Not a lot's known about Jimmy Brown's early life, but he had a fascinating one, nonetheless. James Fiala was born January 22nd, 1990. Well, actually, I forgot our normal thing. Let's get to it. James Fiala on the sit-down. All right. James Fiala was born January 22nd, 1919 in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. And as we know from history and from what we've talked about on our show, a lot of famous Cosa Nostra people have come from Bensonhurst. It is probably the most mob-connected area in the United States, really, during the heyday. People like Carlo Gambino, Sammy Gravano, Joe Colombo, Anthony Casso, tons of mob guys came from Bensonhurst. It was a mob stronghold. And the truth of the matter is, it was just ingrained in that neighborhood for a long period of time that the mob was the business. And generally, if you were a youth, you would pretty much kind of fall in line and go with where things took you. That's just how it was. Coming up, Jimmy Brown would actually meet one of his closest confidants in grammar school, an individual called Bill Willie the Fox Martocchia. And he would remain Jimmy Brown's closest ally, really, until the end. He would eventually work for him out of the Veteran Friends Social Club, which we'll get to in just a little bit. By Jimmy Brown's early 30s, he actually moved him and his family out to Staten Island, but he would remain in Brooklyn from a business standpoint his entire career. But Jimmy Brown was really coming up by his early 30s. He was a short, stocky guy, definitely a tough individual. But he was running numbers, running errands, bookmaking, doing that sort of thing. And actually would be convicted in 1951 of bookmaking, where he would pay a $25 fine. Didn't end up going to jail for that. And that wouldn't change really until the late stages of his life. Jimmy Brown was terrific and adept at evading prosecution, really even being arrested. But during his early 30s, he would catch the eye of Carlo Gambino, who by this point was really just a regular guy in the Mangano crime family. Eventually, Albert Anastasia would take over and Carlo would become underboss. And Jimmy Brown was very close to Carlo Gambino. He actually acted as his bodyguard and driver in the early 50s and mid 50s. And as we know, in the kind of the five families auspice, by this point in the mid 50s, Carlo Gambino had become underboss. He had become, I think, pretty disillusioned with Albert Anastasia. We obviously know Vito Genovese was moving to take out Frank Costello. Lucky Luciano was out of the picture for the most part. And they were kind of trying to control the families. And I think Carlo realized, as the wily, cagey fox that he was, Vito would kind of take care of business and I can kind of slot in as the new boss of this family. As we know, eventually in 1957, Albert Anastasia would be killed inside the Park Sheraton Hotel in Midtown Manhattan. And Carlo Gambino would take over the Gambino crime family. Now, it's important to understand where Jimmy Brown is during all this. Obviously, he is the driver for a period of time for Carlo Gambino, but Jimmy Brown was actually under the auspice and crew of a guy, Armand Reva. Armand Reva worked out of the Manhattan area and actually had a pretty big time crew. At one point, Carlo was under Armand Reva. But Armand Reva had a ton of guys under him, including Jimmy Brown Fiala, Tato Arello. If you know anything about Tato, he was, according to Sammy Gravano, Gravano's mentor, Trigger Mike Chiesa, Fat Andy Ruggiano, and Carmine Fatico. We all know Carmine Fatico as being the kind of early mentor to John Gotti Sr. So, Armand Reva had a pretty hefty crew. Now, Armand Reva actually went to Apalachin with Carlo Gambino, interestingly enough. But the problem that Armand Rava had was he was a loyalist to Albert Anastasia. And there was an enmity between him and Carlo. Eventually, after the meeting, Carlo decides, you know what, Armand Rava has got to go. We'll cut him loose, get rid of him. And that's where Neil Delacroce takes over that crew. And interestingly enough, there were so many people in that crew. They actually split the crew in two factions. They were all one. Some went under the control of Neil Delacroce. The rest went under the control of a guy, Anthony Rizzo. Now, Jimmy Brown would head under the tutelage of Anthony Rizzo. And the old connection that Jimmy Brown had to Carlo Gambino was one that would provide fruitfulness. Jimmy Brown would be point man on the garbage industry. And the late 50s was an interesting time in New York City, because what was happening was in that year, and really in the late 50s, New York City decides to say, you know what, we have 250,000 private businesses at one point. We need to start, kind of divvying this out. So what they do is they decide to license garbage pickup to private companies. And it's not just sanitation that handles it. So that allows the mob to kind of slot in and say, you know what, we'll put our people in place. We'll get sweetheart deals through unions, and we will control the price tag of garbage pickup in New York City. Right. So when you look at all, when it's all said and done, the haulers would kind of sell the routes among themselves. They decided what the charge was to pick up garbage. And if you didn't like it, you pretty much got in fucking line, or you had to deal with people you didn't want to deal with. And what that meant was the mob could control pricing. Now, Jimmy Brown Fiala was the controller of this. He handled this. Now, the Lucchese's were involved as well. The Genovese's eventually, Ali Shades Malangone would handle that. But Jimmy Brown was the guy. And by, you know, the 60s and 70s, New York City businesses were paying twice as much as any other big city to get garbage hauled out of their business. So now you look at a typical mom and pop store, right? Let's say a garbage or a grocery store. I mean, they would pay about $15,000 a year to get their garbage picked up. Con Edison could charge as, they'd be charged as much as $2-3 million. And Jimmy Brown was taking 50%, and he was taking 50% and kicking it up as well. And according to Ronald Goldstock, in the carding industry, Jimmy Fiala resolved disputes, deflected attention, and surrounded himself with trustworthy people. It was an approach that worked well in the underworld. He was the dominant guy in garbage. And it's that simple. I mean, this is a billion-dollar business. Again, billion with a B. And John Gotti once made an interesting point about Jimmy Brown failure. He was caught on surveillance saying, Jimmy Brown, he took the garbage industry and turned it into a candy store. It was that simple. He was extorting and skimming millions of dollars. And again, let's just put out a number. Let's say Jimmy Brown was making $20 million a year off garbage. He was taking 10 for himself and kicking 10 up to their family. So Jimmy Brown was always going to have a job in the business, because earners don't get killed. The mob's too greedy. So Jimmy Brown would create a very hefty position for himself. He would control a association called the Trade Waste Association of Greater New York. He also had control of the Teamsters 213, and he was very close with Bernard Adelstein, who controlled the Teamsters. So this was something that was a huge, huge moneymaker for the mob. By 1971, Jimmy Brown Fiala was bringing in tons of cash. And whether it was Carlo, it really didn't matter. Everyone loved Jimmy Brown, and he had a lot of connection through the family. By that point in 1971, he would become a capo regime in the Gambino crime family and would work out of a place called the Veteran Friend Social Club at 1468 86th Street in Bensonhurst. Now, remember, coming up, he would be very close with his childhood friend, Bill Martocchio. He would act as Jimmy Brown's closest confidant. He would also work under Jimmy Brown in insurance underwriting and claims adjustment for not only garbage hauling companies, but for trucking and different companies as well. Also in the crew was Joe the Cat LaForte, Anthony Vita, Tommy Spinelli, Louis Astuto, and guys like Joey Cigars, Frank Olino, who would eventually take over garbage once Jimmy Brown would go out of the picture. Now, I say one of those names with importance, Joe the Cat LaForte. He was part of Jimmy Brown's crew. And, you know, we could devote a show to Joe the Cat LaForte as well. But you look at let's just look at the powerful duo of Jimmy Brown as capo and Joe the Cat as a soldier. Joe the Cat was an incredibly prolific earner. And between Joe the Cat and Jimmy Brown and one crew, I mean, they were making millions every year. Jimmy Brown in garbage and Joe the Cat in real estate. Joe the Cat LaForte had real estate in New York back when it wasn't popular to have real estate in New York. He was in Soho. He was in Chelsea. He was in Little Italy. He was in Greenwich. He was in all these places before it was popular. He had amassed a huge real estate portfolio and was kicking up, again, under John Gotti, millions of dollars. It's that simple. These guys were longtime people. They were powerful, and they were kicking up millions. By this point in the 70s, Jimmy Brown had actually moved his family, really in the 50s, he moved his family out to Staten Island, and he would live at 275 Evergreen Avenue in Dungan Hills, Staten Island. Keep in mind, you know, if you've ever, and again, you'd have no reason to look this up, but if you've ever looked up 275 Evergreen Avenue, it's really a fascinating home. Jimmy Brown was a very rich man, but he lived in a very modest rancher. Interestingly enough, it was at the end of a dead end street, and Jimmy Brown was cagey. It was the end of the dead end. He knew he could spot law enforcement. He was smart in every level. And I really wanted to talk a little bit more about Jimmy Brown's cautious manner and demeanor. At one point, the federal government said that Jimmy Brown was one of the most careful, discreet people they had ever dealt with. In fact, his whole thing was he was the complete opposite of John Gotti. His thought was, I don't even want to be heard, let alone seen or in the company of anybody. And at one point, the FBI actually was bugging Paul Castellano's house. Eventually, in 1976, Carlo Gambino would die, and he would make Paul Castellano the boss of the Gambino crime family. And that would be good as well for Jimmy Brown, because he was a very close Gambino and Castellano ally. And Jimmy Brown actually would make so much money that he would actually go see Paul Castellano up at the White House almost daily. And during 1983, the FBI was bugging Castellano's house. They would report that Jimmy Brown was present for, quote, hundreds of hours. And during a six-month period, Jimmy Brown was counted. He spoke less than 10 words the entire 6 months. He also had no landline telephones. Obviously, cell phones weren't around. That wasn't a problem. Jimmy Brown really was in the perfect time. Okay, he realized, if I don't say anything, they can't get me on anything. It's pretty simple. And not only was he very cautious on not being caught on wiretap, he was also very discreet in his own crew. He would very well never be seen with anyone. He was very big with walk and talks to avoid surveillance inside buildings. It's hard to bug the air, right? You can't just throw, I guess now you could with drones and things. But back then, you know, if someone was walking down 86th Street, there's no way to bug that. It's a private conversation between two people. And this would allow him to put a block up between him and law enforcement. And you'd have to wonder, I'm sure they were frustrated. This guy's making a ton of money. He's very insulated, and we can't get him on anything. It's pretty crazy. Jimmy Brown was an old school quintessential mob guy, and he did it right. You have to wonder, once Paul Castellano went, you'd have to wonder, where would the family have been if Jimmy Brown took over as opposed to John Gotti, right? So Carlo dies, Paul takes over, and that was big because they were big earners. They're making a ton of money, Paul and Jimmy, nonetheless. By 1983, Jimmy Brown failure would have to kind of dodge a little bit of the law. He'd be arrested on a racketeering charge, one count of racketeering. He'd ultimately, though, be acquitted of that charge and get through. So, again, keep in mind, by 1983, you know, Jimmy Brown is, you know, 64 years old. He's never been to prison, never. He's made money hand over fist, and he's never been to prison. And he continues 30 years later to run a vast enterprise inside the trash unions. And by this point, it's also important to understand, Jimmy Brown is making inroads in other families. He's starting to get the respect of the Genovese crime family, the Lucchese crime family. He worked close with the Genoveses in the trash business. And he was someone that Chin Gigante liked. He liked his old school nature. He liked the fact that he was quiet and cautious. And there was a growing thought that, you know, Jimmy Brown might be a good boss down the road. As we know, in 1985, things would happen that would change the forecast of the Gambino crime family. As we know, on December 16th, 1985, boss Paul Castellano would travel to Sparks Steakhouse. Now, the important and interesting point in all this is, we all know what happened here, but we have to talk about who was inside the restaurant waiting for Paul Castellano that night. It was none other than Jimmy Brown Fiala. He was waiting for Paul for dinner to talk about the garbage business and other mob rackets, and was actually inside when the assassination went down. Paul, as we know, along with his driver, Tommy Bilotti, would be killed in front of Sparks Steakhouse. And at that point, John Gotti takes over the family. Now, under Gotti, Jimmy Brown would maintain the same job titles. He wouldn't lose anything. John was smart enough to realize Jimmy Brown's a great earner, and John was greedy. He wasn't going to not keep Jimmy Brown. He also had a respect for Jimmy Brown. He knew his old school. He knew he was a guy that he'd want around and that he needed to have. Behind the scenes, you know, I think Vincent Gigante obviously hated John Gotti, wanted him dead. He didn't like the fact of what he did against Paul. They obviously had the thought of killing John Gotti. And if we remember, one of the other main kind of things that would happen in the Gotti regime, if you will, Frank DiCicco would be killed. And that would actually happen directly outside of the Veteran Friends Social Club, which Jimmy Brown worked out of. That would happen right outside the building on April 13, 1986. He went to see Jimmy Failia, and the car was bombed. He went out to leave, the car blew up. A lot of people thought that that bomb was probably meant for John Gotti. So, you know, Jimmy Brown was around a lot of really important things that went down, right? And I think slowly but surely, Vincent Gigante realized that, you know, I want Jimmy Brown in control. John Gotti's a fucking loose cannon. I think a lot of people in the family probably said, you know what, Jimmy Brown would probably be better for this family than John, but everyone was making money. And I think Jimmy Brown kind of just said, you know what, the boss is the boss is the boss. I'm old school. That's how it works. My time will come. Maybe it won't, but I'm still making a ton of money. We'll let John take all the heat, and I'll just sit back and do my thing. It's pretty simple. The problem that Jimmy Brown would ultimately have would be late in his life. As we know, in you know the late 80s, early 90s, John Gotti, Frank LoCascio, and Sammy Gravano would be arrested and given a bunch of mob crime, including murder. Interestingly enough, while awaiting trial in 1990, John Gotti would create a triumvirate of people that would run the family, including his son, John Jr., and his brother, Peter Gotti. Now, one of the things that Gotti Sr. would tell Jr. and his brother was that we want Jimmy Brown, we want the old guy in front. We want him as kind of the acting front boss. But Junior's the ultimate decision maker. He makes the last decision. And he and that was a respect for Jimmy Brown. I think he knew that Jimmy Brown was a cagey guy. We want him in control. And you know, we have to wonder if the Gotti group was never a part of the mob, you know, Jimmy Brown would have been the boss. It's just that simple. After Paul Casson, Jimmy Brown was the guy. That simple. And that's what makes this guy so powerful. He was an old school guy. He had all the respect. It was all about connections, and he did it all the right way. The problem was during all the Gotti stuff, as we know, Mr. Gravano decides to testify. He decides to turn rat. And this would be where it would all come crashing down for Jimmy Brown Fiala. I'm going to talk about court testimony in a 1992 trial involving Sammy Gravano, the chief witness, and the prosecutor, John Gleason. I want to talk about kind of how this all went down and how Jimmy Brown's name gets brought up. Gleason would say, you mentioned a number of times Jimmy Brown. What was his responsibility? Gravano would respond, he controlled the garbage industry for us. Gleason would respond, when you say controlled the garbage industry, what do you mean? Gravano, he was controlled private garbage industry. He is the head of the association and controls the union, Local 813. The union 813 president, Bernie Adelstein, answers directly to Jimmy Brown, so he controls the garbage industry for the family. Local 813 is what union, says Gleason? Gravano, garbage. He would also talk about other things that Jimmy Brown did inside the union, things of that nature, but then something will come up that would be the death knell for Jimmy Brown, frankly. Gleason, in 1989, Jimmy Brown came to the administration regarding a murder, Gravano, yes. Gleason, how did that come about? Gravano, he came in to John and said a made member, Tommy Sparrow Spinelli, went to the grand jury and was going back. He was advised by his attorney to tell the truth and cooperate. That is exactly what he was going to do. Gleason, whose crew was Tommy Sparrow in? Gravano, he was a made member in Jimmy Brown's crew. Was Sparrow his nickname or real name? Gravano, I don't know. That is how I know him. Gleason, did you know him well? Gravano, no. Gleason, did Jimmy Brown report this to John Gotti? Gravano, yes. And as a result, Gleason said, what happened? Gravano, John Gotti told me about it. He told me that he had given them a contract to kill Tommy Sparrow. Gleason, he had given a contract to Jimmy Brown, a contract to kill Tommy Sparrow. He believed Louis Fats and Danny Marino were in on it. He wasn't sure how fast it would get done. He told me to get on it and make sure it was done before he went to the grand jury. Gleason, before Tommy Sparrow went to the grand jury? Gravano, yes. Gleason, did you get on it? Gravano, I got involved immediately. Gleason, what did you do once you got involved? I got a hold of Louis Fats and Danny Marino. He told me that Philly Dogs would be on it. He wasn't coming in. They weren't talking with him. I got in touch with Joe Watts to get a place ready. Gleason, a place ready for what? To bury him. We made an appointment one night. I told Louis Fats to make an appointment with Tommy in a last ditch effort. Jimmy wanted to talk to him and he could talk. Just wanted an opportunity for Jimmy to talk with him and everything would be okay. He wasn't sure if he would come out of his cafe to meet. So basically what he's saying here is they set up the murder and that Jimmy Brown was the main conspirator to kill Tommy Sparrow. Tommy Sparrow Spinelli was part of Jimmy Brown's crew. He was a rat and Jimmy Brown was old school. He knew that he couldn't have Tommy Sparrow Spinelli implicate him. And in this case, the individual to bring Jimmy Brown down was Sam Gravano. Keep in mind, in 1993, Jimmy Brown Fiala was charged with racketeering and conspiracy to murder Thomas Spinelli. In 1994, luckily, due to poor health, keep in mind by this point, Jimmy Brown was a beaten man. He had heart problems. He was overweight. He had hypertension, high blood pressure, diabetes, all sorts of health issues. In 1994, he got a plea deal. He pleaded guilty to one count of conspiracy to commit murder. And subsequently, Jimmy Brown Fiala would be sentenced to 7 years in federal prison. Now, again, Jimmy Brown was in his late 70s at this point. He wasn't in good health. He had never been to prison. And this was going to be, you know, probably tough. You have to remember, I mean, the federal government doesn't exactly treat you real well inside prison, especially if you're a mobster. You know, you can have cancer, whatever. They're not going to make it easy. You know, it's hard to have diabetes and hypertension and all this stuff outside, let alone in prison. And, you know, Jimmy Brown probably was given a death sentence. I mean, he was old. He probably wasn't going to get out alive. And he didn't. On August 5th, 1999, about 5 years into his sentence. So he was getting close to getting out. On August 5th, 1999, Jimmy Brown Fiala would die of natural causes in a federal prison in Fort Worth, Texas. He would be buried in New Dorp, Staten Island, New York. So, you know, that's the story of Jimmy Brown. And I think when we look back on Jimmy Brown, you'll never hear his name mentioned when we talk about the mob. And your normal, you know, fan of the mob has no idea who Jimmy Brown is. But for 40 years, Jimmy Brown pretty much ran the garbage industry. He was one of the most prolific earners, really, in the history of the mob, you know, especially in the Gambino family. He was able to wind his way through different leadership, all the way back from Carlo Gambino, Albert Anastasia, Paul Castellano, John Gotti, John Jr. He weaved his way and made money, insulated himself. And the only thing that kept him down was what Sammy Gravano said happened. If Jimmy Brown was in a little bit better shape, he would have died in his own bed, just like Carlo did. And that was probably the right end for Jimmy Brown Fiala. Jimmy Brown was not a hitman. He was not a truly dangerous lunatic and individual. He ran a very lucrative business and many others for the mob. He was a man's man. He was a stone cold gangster. And he was a guy that really lived the mob life. Now, he skimmed a lot of money and really cheated his way to make money. I'm not saying he's a great human being. But when we look at, and that's the thing, when we look at mobsters on this show, we're not glorifying what they do. We're just talking about it from mob circles. Jimmy Brown was a powerful guy and a very rich guy at the end of the day. And yeah, I think if we never hear the name Gotti, frankly, Jimmy Brown would have been the boss of the family for a while. And you know, let's be honest, we have to ask ourselves, why didn't anyone ever do anything? Why didn't Jimmy Brown kind of side, and why didn't they take care of John Gotti? And you know, because I don't think that's what Jimmy Brown was. He was the boss is the boss kind of guy, and he's not going to go out of line. And I think he realized, let John take the heat. It's only, you have to only wonder, if he'd have never did the Tommy Sparrow thing, you know, he definitely would have died alone and never would have went to prison, would never went to prison at all in his entire life. Couple of fun facts about Jimmy Brown as we end the show. A lot of people asked, you know, what's the reason for the name Jimmy Brown? That was said to be from his love of brown clothing. He loved the brown, which, you know, definitely sharp, chocolate brown suit. Nothing wrong with that. There's also a funny story that I've read many times during his later years, during his conspiracy to commit murder case late in his career. He walked with a cane. He was obviously in poor health, and he was outside of the courtroom, and photographers and reporters were bothering him, asking him questions. And he raised his cane and said, quote, "Get the fuck away from me," swinging the cane wildly, according to Jerry Capici. It's the kind of guy Jimmy Brown was. He didn't want to be on camera. He didn't want to be seen. He didn't want to be heard. It was also well known in mob circles that if you wanted a great pastry, make sure you head up to the Trade Association for garbage. It was always known that Jimmy Brown would always have the best of pastries. He enjoyed Alta's Bakery on 18th Avenue in Brooklyn, and he was very well known to partake. If you've ever seen Jimmy Brown, he enjoyed the pastries, the cannolis. He was very well-liked, and he was very respected. And that's the goal of our show. We want to talk about, and obviously the main guys, Carlo and John and Vinny Gigante, but it's also important to talk about people like Jimmy Brown, who you know, was a gangster until the end. It's that simple. Thanks as always for listening. We appreciate you. Please check out our sponsors. That's how we're able to keep the show free. Please go check that out, especially if you're having some tough times in your life. I definitely recommend BetterHelp. It'll get you feeling better during the Christmas season. Also, make sure you check us out on Twitter at the Sitdown 7. It's a great resource to kind of follow the show and see what's going on. And you can check us out on YouTube as well. And if you enjoy our show, whether you're on iTunes, Spotify, wherever, please tell your friends. Please tell someone that might like it. And make sure you also give us a rating and a review. We appreciate all the reviews regardless. I am Jeff Nadeau. Next time you talk to me, I will have one fight under my belt, and I'm hoping to go 1-0. As always, I appreciate you listening. I thank you for your support, and I thank all of you for checking out the show. We've really enjoyed doing this, and as we head into the Christmas season and the new year, we're going to have plenty more great mob shows here coming up. Thanks, as always, for listening to The Sit Down. We'll see you next time.